which has a combination roller stone system, and they sift. And then there's Camas Country down in Eugene that does some stone milling. And there are a few around. But for us in the lab, most of what we do is stone milling. And then with the stone milling, then we figure out the best way to use that product. And again, I'll just go back to something comforting as a molasses cookie, you know, that has a good crisp and snap to it, that we can do with 100% whole wheat. And the beauty there is it works, right? So we haven't met a pastry that you can't do at 100% whole wheat. it just takes a little adjustment and wanting to do it. And then you get into the more complicated things, breads and pastas, you can do it too. So we've just accepted this system of it has to be white flour because that works. That's not true, certainly historically and even more recently. And that we're going to take out everything that we want in it just to do that. So yes, we work with stone mills quite a bit. And what I'll say too is that a regional grain economy is coming on very strong right now across the country in places that have lost their wheat. About 100 years ago, we lost almost 25,000 flour mills in this country. Today, we have less than 200. That's a fact, and it says so much you don't even have to talk about it, right? I mean, uh-huh. We lost 25,000 flour mills for holy cow, right? So those communities lost a lot there. They lost a contribution to their own food within their own region. They lost the jobs. They lost a lot of things. They lost the local use for grains that they produced. And we centralized. It's tough to find something as centralized as wheat processing, which would be milling, and even baking, right? So we're part of a movement that hopes to decentralize some of these things, bring value back to our communities, whether it's making, you know, flour tortillas or baguettes or beer or whiskey within your own region. And again, not just for the reason of local, but for the reason of our economies and our own and folks within our community having good jobs. The director of the Port of Skagit, where we're located, Patsy Martin, tells us that through the work of the Bread Lab in the past 3 years, 200 living wage jobs have been created within a 10-minute walk of where we are.
Well, that's giving me a chill. That is so wonderful.
Yeah, and that's malting, that's milling, that's brewing. We have a brewery there, Chuckanut Brewery, that does 10,000 barrels a year.
And I am absolutely confident that there's no white flour that has any hits of chocolate or spicy overtones.
You're not kidding. Yeah, you're not kidding.
I'm confident about that. When you started talking about losing the 25,000 mills and the other mid-size production places, it sort of matches that losing of the 6 million farmers we've also lost.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
It is heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. It's this very aggressive centralization, and it's very extractive, right? So if you have that few mills, you have that few facets of the industry, they're going in and pulling out, right? So you're going to go in and you're going to pull out the production off of a few million acres, and then you're going to take that somewhere. So you're going to pay as little as possible for it. That's the model. You're going to do as little to it. That's the model. And then you're going to bring it back into those communities and sell it, right? At how many times? 2, 3, 4, 10 times, mm-hmm. right? What's the value? And where has that value been dispersed to? We know where it's going. We know where it's coming from. It's coming from our own communities. It's going away, and then something's coming back. And you're from Oregon, up here in Washington, like Oregon. You know, early in the 70s, we had the mantra of don't export raw logs, right? And the idea was we're going to cut down our cascades, send these logs away, and then someone's going to make 2x4s and plywood and sell them back to us, right? So wait a minute, we've lost our trees and now we're paying for something that was ours, and those jobs are centralized somewhere else. Same with wheat or anything else, right? We're going to send it away and bring back flour. That doesn't make sense for us economically.
Yes, and or for our taste buds either.
Huge. That's right. So then do we lose the idea that we like wheat that tastes this way or pickles that taste that way? Or what are our tastes within our region? And we have that. We have cuisine within our country, right? But it's easy to lose, too, when everything tastes the same.
Well, it's been a true honor to be talking with you today. I've learned so much, and I am so grateful for this wonderful work that you're doing. Thank you so much. Learn more about the Bread Lab, at .wsu.edu. And just a pleasure to be talking with you today.
Great. Thanks, Teresa. It was fun.
You can listen to Rootstock Radio on the go, wherever you get your podcasts. And find us online at rootstockradio.com. Rootstock Radio is brought to you by Organic Valley.
This is KZFR 90.1 FM Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia, where we'll be talking about Jaws and the mob. Stay tuned and learn about why this program is about neither sharks nor gangsters. You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. We're calling this show an attempt at wit, Jaws and the Mob, and now it's time for us to explain why this show is about neither sharks nor gangsters.
With us on the phone now, from Palo Alto, are Sandra Kahn and Paul Ehrlich, co-authors of a new book entitled Jaws, The Story of a Hidden Epidemic. It argues that our jaws aren't developing properly and our teeth are increasingly crowded and crooked, leading to a multitude of health issues, many of them not immediately apparent. They argue that merely applying braces and pulling out wisdom teeth are not necessarily solutions to the problem. And we'll explore both the causes of and the possible cures for the epidemic. Welcome to both of you.
Nice to be here.
Great.
I want to do a little bit of biography. Sandra Kahn is Doctor of Dental Surgery with an MS in Dentistry. She has degrees from the University of Mexico and the University of the Pacific. She also has 25 years of clinical experience in orthodontics and is part of the craniofacial anomalies teams at the University of California, San Francisco, and Stanford University.
And Paul Ehrlich has been a powerful voice for humankind since the publication of the 1968 apocryphal book, The Population Bomb. He's Bing Professor of Population Studies Emeritus and President of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University. Paul is one of the founders of the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, acronym MAHB, and pronounced MOB, a global organization working to get the findings of science into public policy for the good of the planet. So, again, welcome.
Nice to be here again.
Let's begin with your collaboration. How did a population biologist and an orthodontist find common interests? When did you meet and how did you get started on this book?
Well, we met because we had a mutual colleague. Sandra is very interested in conservation. She and her husband, David Leventhal, have a wonderful eco-resort near Zihuatanejo in Mexico.
Oh, I love that.
And one
place.
Of their friends, they formed an NGO, was Gerardo Ceballos at the University of Mexico, and they were working on conservation of jaguars. But it just so happens that Gerardo is one of my closest colleagues in evolutionary biology and ecology. We've been working a lot on extinctions. And Gerardo introduced us. And we discovered a mutual interest, David and Sandra and Ann and I, in fermented grape juice.
Mm.
Many
nice
dinners
interest.
With fermented grape juice.
All right.
And Sandra introduced me, to my great embarrassment, to the biggest environmental problem ever constructed by human beings that I had no idea about, and that is the problems created by first going into agriculture and then into industrialization, and particularly what it's done to our jaws. And Sandra can tell you what we've done to our jaws.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What is the thesis of jaws?
Well, I always like to insert in our biography, or the reason we got together, into the fact that Paul is really interested in anything that has to do with human predicament.
Mm-hmm.
And scientists need to be broader in their views if we are going to focus in trying to solve some of these human predicaments. And having somebody as an evolutionary biologist collaborate with a clinical orthodontist, it really makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
It just looks strange because we tend to be more siloed in our studies and in our knowledge. But all that said, the epidemic really is pretty obvious when you look at how many children, how many people have crowding. And the crowding, just like if you have a classroom and too many chairs, you can't fit them in the classroom. Same thing, the jaws cannot fit all the teeth. So we can see that it's really a problem of the jaws not being big enough. And we've been addressing that as just, the teeth needed to be straight. And sometimes we take teeth out and we just move them around, but we're not addressing the underlying problem, which is the size of the jaws. And the epidemic really goes farther from just seeing something that's aesthetic. We see that the size of the jaws really dictates also the size of the airway and the area that the tongue can live in. So we are seeing a lot of people that have interrupted sleep, and they're having all kinds of problems, which the worst of them is the sleep apnea, which most people are familiar with, which is mm-hmm. when you stop breathing at night. And that creates a lot of, biological stress that will, predispose the person to a lot of other disease.
In what way is this an epidemic?
Well, there's just, if you go and you look at children, and I'm 50 years old, and when I was a child in my classroom, there was maybe one or two kids that needed to have braces, that their teeth were crowded. And if you go and look at children today, you will see that not only most of them are in need or already wearing braces, but you can see that most kids are hanging their mouths open and they have really bad postures. And the open mouth really, we can talk about why this is happening, but it's really a result of not having enough strength in the muscles in the face to really be able to keep the mouth closed. So every child out there is eating a very soft diet, it's not being breastfed enough, and the result is really that their muscles are weak. And we can see it if you start looking around you, and I have colleagues and friends that blame me for destroying their life because they say they can't see a group of children and not start, noticing that they all have their mouth open.
Hmm.
That was not happening, 50 or 100 years ago.
My colleagues, many of them are now on CPAP machines, mm-hmm. including my daughter, because this problem of sleep apnea, in which you basically start choking in the middle of the night and wake up, not only causes misery, that is sleeplessness and so on, but mm-hmm. as Sandra mentioned, it also increases the chance you get heart disease, cancer, depression, ADHD, diabetes, even Alzheimer's disease. It's a huge public health problem. And there's very good scientific background on this. That is, for instance, one of my colleagues here, Richard Klein, is maybe the top human paleontologist in the world. He knows more about the history of our skeletal remains than maybe anybody but Daniel Lieberman at Harvard. And they both agree hunter-gatherers did not have crooked teeth. Hunter-gatherers had more than enough room for their third molars, so that the whole idea of wisdom teeth is an idea that came up basically after the jaws had shrunk a very long way, so that there's no longer room for the last molars to naturally erupt. And there's been some very interesting studies showing that the shrinkage of our jaws is still going on as we go to softer and softer diets. The people, for example, looking at remains in Norwegian or Swedish cemeteries from 300 years ago, measuring the jaws there and then measuring the jaws of present-day Scandinavians, you can see the shrinkage is still going on. And this ties not just into having a softer and softer diet, it also ties into the other thing that came with industrialization, which is moving indoors. You move indoors, there's more allergens. Our kids end up having stuffy noses for the first few years of their lives, particularly if they're in a daycare center without proper sanitation measures. And we know from some hideous experiments done 40 or 50 years ago on monkeys that if you stuff the nose of a rhesus monkey, its jaw development goes to hell. And the same thing happens if you stuff the nose of kids. And we have some pictures in Jaws showing, for example, what happened to a kid who was allergic to a gerbil that he got, had stuffy noses for a few years, and see the change that it made in his jaw development. So this is a massive public health problem that I was stupid enough to totally ignore. I never asked myself as an evolutionist, you know, why are all these kids suddenly wearing braces, and why do we have wisdom teeth? It doesn't make any sense evolutionarily. Until you start thinking about the gigantic environmental changes that we've made in connection with first agriculture and then industrialization.
You say in the book that this is not a traditional evolutionary change. That is, it's happened over the past century or two centuries. Is this a heritable trait? When does the jaw deformation set in with our newborn kids?
This is almost entirely environmental.
Okay.
There hasn't been anywhere near enough time for evolutionary, right. genetic uh-huh. evolutionary change to take place, even if there were strong selection pressures, which there aren't. But no, there's no question at all, even though you get these funny stories that, oh, the problem with crooked teeth is a dad with big teeth came from some part of the world and mated with a woman with a small jaw, and that's the problem. That's mm-hmm. evolutionarily nonsensical. This is an environmental problem. It's an environmental problem, one of the, I think it's the only massive environmental problem we're facing, and as you know, we're facing many of them, where you can actually protect your kids from it and yourself to a degree. And one of the things we do in the book is tell how to tell whether your kids are getting into trouble early on in life, not when they're 12 years old, but when they're 12 months old, and what you can do about it. So it's the book is written basically to mothers because and fathers mm-hmm. because they got to take care of their kids. And we hope to medical and dental schools, where Sandra already mentioned, we're much too siloed. Why should the development of the muscles of the mouth be ignored when the development of every other muscle is in all the health things? You know, you got to exercise this, lose it or use it, and so on. And we don't pay any attention to the jaws, which are absolutely critical to our health.
So you said that there are some symptoms when children are very young that parents can recognize and do something about. What are some of those symptoms?
Well, the first symptom that it's easy for anybody to see is an open mouth, because you can see a newborn baby needs to be sleeping, you know, passively with a mouth closed, the lips together, and a nose that's, you know, taking in air without being able to see that he's breathing. So if you see a child any age, even newborn, that has the mouth open, you can either train him to close the mouth, because it could just be the fact that, you know, the baby's not being guided to close the mouth, or there might be a problem that needs to be addressed, and it could be addressed all the way from birth. But, you know, open mouth is the first one, and the next thing that we can see very early on is if a child smiles and you see a lot of gum, we call that a gummy smile, that's a problem. Any child that snores, that's a red alarm. You know, children should never snore. Really, adults shouldn't either. But, you know, a child, you know, that's not overweight and should be, you know, the breathing should always be passive and very quiet. If a kid has, you know, a attention disorders, you can pretty much assume that there's a breathing problem, there's a sleep problem. If they wake up and you see that the the bed sheets are disheveled and there's been a lot of movement in the night, there might be something there. If they wake up and they're tired, because a child should wake up and be very energetic. I mean, I'm not talking about teenagers. I'm talking about young children should be well rested. So these are all kinds of things that a parent can address. And our society is really not paying enough attention to prevention. And if you take a newborn, you take a two-year-old, and you start doing some, you know, training with them and addressing problems early, then you will not get to the point where the teeth come in and they don't have room.
So I have a couple of questions related to what you just asked and what you just said. They have breathing problems from birth. So what's causing that at birth?
Well, you could have problems with, you know, we live indoors, so indoors we have a lot more particles in the air that the children might be breathing. But one of the most exciting or more interesting books that I came around when we were doing the research for our book, for JAWS, was George Catlin, which in the 1850s, mm-hmm. went to live with the American Indians that lived outdoor. Mm-hmm. And he came back after a few decades of living with the Native Americans, and he wrote a book called Shut Your Mouth and Save Your Life. And he described the fact that the natives that were living outdoors, they had very low child mortality, and they nicknamed the whites, they nicknamed them not only pale faces, but also dark mouths or black mouths.
Mm-hmm.
So the whites that were living indoors, they were already hanging their mouth open. And a baby definitely, you know, they go to daycare so early, or even when we just bring him home from the hospital, we're living indoors. So sometimes the babies may have issues. But one of the very interesting things from Caitlin's book is that he noticed that the midwives, they would teach the young mothers to take the baby off the breast, and then pinch very lightly the lips so that the baby would know and start, you know, breathing through the nose. So there's little practices that naturally we could do. And if we're not doing them, then a newborn could start developing that mouth breathing that really they shouldn't have. But, mm-hmm. you know, we know that there's all kinds of issues, and we can do a little bit of prevention early, and that goes a long way.
There are a couple of directions I'd like to go with that. One, you are critical of a lot of orthodontic processes, as we said earlier, moving the teeth around, yanking the wisdom teeth. What are some of the precautions? You call it forwardontics. What are some of the recommendations that you make and what you do in your own practice, Sandra?
Well, the first thing I always like to underline is that I'm not critical. I'm still an orthodontist. And, you know, the orthodontists, we're very good professionals, and we're mm-hmm. driven towards health. But we really need to start, you know, reshaping our techniques with, you know, as we inform ourselves from this epidemic, as I work with anthropologists and evolutionary biologists like Paul, then we need to be changing some of the techniques. And we need to drive our techniques towards health, not towards just, you know, the symptoms and just dealing with the symptoms. So in orthodontics, we tend to rearrange the teeth to fit whatever jaw they have. Traditionally, we used to see kids, you know, in their early teenage years, 12, 13, mm-hmm. and that's too late to do prevention. So in my practice, I like to focus on very young children, and I start giving them exercises and informing the parents and doing, you know, whatever I can early, and then if they get to me later, then we do expansion of the jaws with special techniques that actually focus on the jaw, not on the teeth. We rarely do anything with the teeth. We really just try to stimulate growth by changing practices, by, you know, there's little things that you can do, and Paul thinks we're going to be hated by everyone, but one of the things that we suggest is that children start chewing gum, because that helps them develop the strength so that the jaws can grow and express their full potential.
Well, I think that's great, because I like to chew gum.
As long as they chew with their mouths closed.
And
Sandra has actually found gum that you can re-chew that's mm-hmm. stronger than the gum. We want to encourage gum manufacturers to make ones that exercise your mm-hmm. jaws more.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, the idea that you can re-chew it means you don't stick it under your chair.
Yeah, that's
right.
The other thing.
You can put it behind your ear.
Yeah, that's great. Does the jaw actually change shape during this time? Does it move backward or Is it just that it's a stronger jaw as a result?
Yeah, the jaw is, I'd like to use the analogy of baking a cake. If you want to make a round cake and you put the batter in a square mold and you put it in the oven, but you realize right away you made a mistake, you can get it out and put it in a round mold and you'll have a beautiful cake at the end that's round. But if you don't realize your mistake early and the cake starts baking and you get it out, you'll never quite be able to get a round cake. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, if we address the problems early while the kids are growing, the earliest we address it, the better, the more success we're going to have reshaping the jaws. If we wait until after the first decade of life, then it's very hard. We can still do some techniques to mitigate, you know, whatever problem we have. But with forward onyx, we want to change the habits as soon as possible. So we do three things with what we call forward onyx, which is we change the jaws to fit the teeth, not the teeth to fit the jaws. Mm. So we use techniques to expand and to move the jaws forward. That's why we call it forward onyx. Mm-hmm. We change the habits and we protract the jaws. So there's the three things that we do, but it's really based on growth. So we have to really do forward onyx successfully, we have to address this before 10 years old. So that's mm-hmm. that's really what I'm focusing on in my personal practice.
You, I want to just step back a little bit. You have related the jaws epidemic to a number of diseases and problems that many of them are not obvious, and you warn about not overinterpreting. But what are the implications of your research for things like blood pressure?
The implications are very severe, not well documented scientifically. That is, we know that stress is a huge factor in all kinds of human problems.
Okay.
But we don't know the exact degree of stress. We don't know exactly, for example, if you get sleep apnea every third night, what that does to your chances of getting cancer. Something for your chances of being killed in an automobile accident, particularly sleep apnea and truck drivers, because some people project that the your chances of being killed on the road by a sleep-deprived driver are higher, considerably higher than being killed by a drunk driver.
Really?
The interaction of the jaw to sleep is extremely important, and people are beginning to understand more and more how critical sleep deprivation is to job performance, school performance, disease, and longevity. And the moving indoors, that huge environmental change, we discovered after we published the book that there's a literature building on moving indoors and becoming nearsighted, myopia. And it's becoming more and more common. They're not sure whether it's because you don't look at a distance enough or whether you are not getting the right amount of light. But it leads to things like retinal detachment. There's this terrible plague of myopia that's now being documented. So it's a huge environmental change that after all, I'm supposed to be an environmentalist and an evolutionary biologist. I missed the whole damn thing. It's really embarrassing. Sandra has really embarrassed me, but fortunately she sent me a lot of good wine, too.
Yeah, good. So are these correlative studies or correlative problems, or are they causal?
No, they're causal.
They're causal.
There's a lot of correlational evidence, but there's also first of all, a huge natural experiment. In the sense of what we've changed, and we've seen what the results are. There's also local causal stuff. For example, you can see in the book pictures of three generations where the grandfather lived in the primitive situation, so-called primitive. The son moved halfway through his life into town and got eating the processed food, and then the grandson had his entire life on the processed food, and you can see the pictures of what happened to their jaws. So this is something that can happen quite rapidly. It's one of the reasons we know that genetics are not deeply involved in it.
Mm-hmm. So is the processed food the main problem with it is that it's soft, that it isn't whole foods?
There are other problems, but what we've discovered is
it chemicals?
The nutritionists have never paid attention to the chewability. You see an ad for V8. Drink your vegetables.
Yeah, right.
There's an article that we saw and subscribed. My wife subscribes to about five of these health things, you know, the Tufts Health newsletter, the Berkeley Health newsletter, and one was on whether or not smoothies are just as healthy for you as eating the fruit. Well, of course, one of the things we've done is selected the fruit to be damn near liquid. The only fruit you normally chew is an apple. The peaches that we get, you could often just poke a hole in the side of it and drink the thing, just suck out the contents. We are actually working with people at Stanford now to try and introduce healthier foods in terms of their consistency to Stanford dormitories and so on. But we are moving to a liquid diet, and you can see the results.
There's definitely anecdotal evidence, which is still, you know, good enough, because we see people that have lived in very traditional societies that are chewing a lot of natural food, that don't have access to industrialized processed foods and sugars, and their facial health and their the size of their jaws and their, you know, their diseases that they have is completely different than our counterparts that are eating processed foods. So, you know, just like Darwin in The Origin of the Species did a lot of observations, and that was, you know, the basis of his theories, the same way we've looked at a lot of people that live in these environments, and we see that they're not everything, but their jaws and a lot of their lifestyle should be emulated, and we could use this to create environments that are conducive to a lot more health.
So you have a number of recommendations, and they're mostly aimed at what you should do with your children, but I find them interesting, and I think they could be helpful to adults. Could you give us an overview of the tips that you have, the recommendations?
Well, one recommendation that I'll just mention before Sandra fills in is something that I totally didn't understand, and that is, if you're able to nurse, and some women aren't, but if you're able to nurse, do it as long as possible, not just because the mother's milk is so much more healthy nutritionally than the substitutes in my cow's milk and so on, but because what I didn't understand is that nursing really exercises a baby's jaw muscles in a way that drinking from a bottle doesn't. Actually, Sandra, tell them your experience.
Well, you know, the personal story is always important in this type of work. And my personal story is, as a working mother, I had my son, and I pumped the milk, and then, you know, I had the daycare or my husband feed him a bottle. And again, I was knowledgeable about the chemical composition of breast milk, but I had no idea the delivery was important. So I messed up myself. And this is how I learned, and then I did some research to try to help my own child. And what I usually tell parents is that we really need to change habits and demand social change, because we need to start looking at the whole picture. And the whole picture is the quality, the chemical composition, and the exercise, what the kids are doing, both from the beginning of life. And, you know, breastfeeding is something that can be difficult for some women. So even if you can't breastfeed, then you can go into weaning children into hard foods that are not as processed. And, you know, daycares can help with this by, you know, fostering environments for, and we call it good oral posture, because the mouth needs to be closed, the kids need to be, you know, sitting straight, and they have to be given foods that are conducive to health. And the parents need to start demanding this. This is the most important part of the prevention, because prevention is always going to be easier than fixing the problem.
You also mentioned posture as an important recommendation. Are you talking about physical posture, or are you talking about mouth posture? Posture?
We have decided in our culture that that the mouth is a separate part of the body, so we're not training our dentists as physicians. But really, we have to look at the whole. We have to, I don't like to use the word holistic, because it gets misunderstood, but we have to see the full picture. And the full picture is, you know, a child that's, you know, looking at electronics all day and it's, you know, looking down and the neck is down, is not going to develop a good jaw, it's not going to develop a good airway. So it's all connected. There's not separate postures. The muscles of the face that help us hold the jaw in the right position are connected to the ones in the neck, to the back. So we need to, in our program, we teach kids from how to sit. We give children chairs that are conducive to a good posture, and we give them indications of how to use electronics in a way that they're not harming their growth. Mm-hmm. So the body posture and oral posture are connected. So we don't see it as separate. But oral posture has not been... you know, we haven't really thought about exercising our jaw, even though we know that if a child doesn't walk for the first 5 years of their life, the legs are not going to develop. And it's the same with the jaw. If a kid is eating nothing but hamburgers and macaroni and cheese and smoothies, the jaws are not going to get exercised, the bones are not going to grow. So when you start explaining this to lay people or parents, it makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating book, deserves reading by people of all ages. You're listening to Ecotopia. We've been talking with Sandra Kahn and Paul Ehrlich about their new book, Jaws, The Story of a Hidden Epidemic. It's published by Stanford University Press. It's available from the publisher, online, and at the many local bookstores that deserve our support. We're going to let Sandra go at this point, although, Sandra, you are more than welcome to stay on the line if you'd like. We're going to ask Paul a little bit about some of his other interests. Thank you, Sandra Kahn, for being with us on Ecotopia this evening.
My pleasure.
Paul, we've spoken with you several times previously on Ecotopia, and we're delighted to have you back on the program. We are always inspired and pushed a little bit by you. We've reminded our listeners frequently of the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, MAHB, M-A-H-B, and we've also interviewed a number of people who've written for MAHB. MAHB has published a number of essays outlining what people can do to take action to preserve the planet. Could you tell us about some of the more encouraging or forward-looking pieces that you've published?
Well, there's now a huge long list of them.
Yes, there is.
The basic idea of the MAHB was to get civil society, A, more united instead of just competing with each other for whose little problem is most important. Look, as Sandra emphasized, at the holistic aspects of it. For instance, we published basically a short version of our book as a blog in the MAHB, because here was something that tied together a whole series of environmental problems. You've published by Julian Cribb, for example, who is one of the top people looking at the entire situation in the world. Has written a number of excellent books and some very good blogs for us. We've had a recent one that interested me a great deal on basically asking the question, what's wrong with the whole system, and coming up with looking at the fact that our concepts of value are all tied into money. This is something relatively new in society. Until a few hundred years ago, people's status was not determined by how much money they had or how much more they had than somebody else. One of the things that we did when we invented agriculture, that allowed one person, it was a response in part, most people think, to the growth of the human population. It allowed a person to get more food than they themselves needed, which allowed specialization. So you could have mechanics and priests and soldiers and so on. That led on to industrialization, and it also led to the invention of poverty. If you look at what we know about from even recent past and further back, hunter-gatherer societies, they were very egalitarian. And the leadership was not elected. The leadership was usually not a single person, and the leadership depended on what area they were leading in, so that the person who led in hunting was the hunt leader, but an old woman might be the leader in settling disputes. Another woman might be the leader in knowing so much about plants that she could be the health provider in the group. another person who was very good at getting things organized, could have been the leader if there was an environmental change they had to deal with. And so we had the invention of poverty and all these other things coming back with technology. And of course, we also had the invention of nuclear weapons. We don't know yet whether moving to agriculture was a successful move for humanity, because we don't know if we're going to survive the coming crash. I don't want to depress you, but I know
that's our next question has to do with the depressing part. But yes,
we now have no government, and we're our government is working to make everything worse, not better.
Right. So, what kind of options are open? Our listeners are engaged, many of them activists. We often feel depressed and even desperate. What's somebody to do, especially those of us who are moderately affluent, doing okay, which includes most of the, not all, but a good percentage of our population is doing okay, even though we have high percentage of poverty. But what's a person to do? We can't get anywhere
I
with the government.
First of all, being an activist, we're not going to get it from the top down, certainly not now.
Right.
Being an activist is very important. Educating yourself is very important, and getting together with your friends is very important. That is not only helps you get political power, which you certainly need if you're going to change the world, but it also is more healthy for you. You live longer if you have a group of supportive friends. So there's lots of things we can do that we like, and there's also almost no area where somebody who wants to be politically active can't enjoy their activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're into, for instance, the outdoors, then you can fight to keep people from continually developing every last bit of outdoors we have in the United States. If you are into trying to get the Environmental Protection Agency refunctional instead of having it destroyed by the person who's running it,
mm-hmm.
then pick at your local congressman. If that person doesn't swear that if he or she remains in office, they're going to do everything possible to see that Pruitt goes back to being an incompetent mm-hmm. lawyer or whatever his idiot job was before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to be politically active. People say, oh, scientists shouldn't be advocates. I think that's something we scientists, many of us, are trying to change.
Right.
Doesn't mean you fake your data, but it means that you say what you think is going on, give the best scientific summary of it, and then say, in my opinion, based on the fact that I've been studying this for the last 40 years, I think we ought to XXX. After all, nobody complained that doctors were saying smoking is bad for you, you ought to give it up. Well, the things we're doing to the environment, the things we're doing to our kids with their diets, are bad for them. So what are we supposed to do? Just say, well, our food is getting more and more liquid. Our children's jaws are getting smaller and smaller. They're having more trouble breathing. They're going to be sicker earlier. I don't know what we ought to do about it. It's like the idiocy on guns. You know, we know what to do about gun death. But the Murder Incorporated, which is the gun industry and their lobbyists in the NRA, Murder Incorporated politically acts better than we do. They're more effective. The way to get these things changed, I think, only a personal opinion, is to get very politically active on these issues. Join the mob, mahb.stanford.edu. Doesn't cost you anything,
mm-hmm.
but you can express your opinions and interact with people who want to make civil society work hard to deal with the huge issues and to make our children and our grandchildren, in my case, our great-grandchildren, better off.
Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of discussion in recent years about education that includes science and society, that looks at the unintended consequences of science. Do you sense that the schools are taking this on as an issue? Are new PhDs in science coming out with a broader perspective of how that can influence public policy?
A little bit, but not much. Harvard and Stanford, in my view, those kinds of universities are doing a disgraceful job. They could do much better. It doesn't mean that they're, for instance, Stanford, I think we have, if you put them all together, maybe the best group of environmental scientists in the world. But you can go all the way through Stanford or Harvard or Penn or any of the big name universities and still not learn where your food comes from beyond the supermarket, what the second law of thermodynamics means to your life, why the climate is changing and how we know human beings are changing it, on and on. You can find that out if you sort through and take the right courses, but the universities themselves are not designed to deal with the existential threats that humanity is now facing. They're much too conservative. The department structure at Stanford was actually designed by an old friend of mine that I don't think you've ever interviewed. Did you ever interview Aristotle? That's where the disciplines came from.
Right, right.
Try to pick a classical university department and name for me one big human problem that could be solved within the confines of that department. I pushed, when our president was Dick Lyman, I suggested to him we close the university, this is maybe 30 years ago, close the university down for a year and have all the faculty and students work on redesigning a university for the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But we're still in the 19th century here. Harvard's still in the 16th century, probably. my answer is we are not, as educators, doing the job we should be doing. And that ties in with the issues of advocacy and so on. It's a very tricky area. I think you probably interviewed Steve Schneider one time before he died, the great climatologist, and we discussed a lot scientists' responsibility in this area. We came up with a set of rules we try and follow, and that Sandra and I with JAWS have tried to follow very carefully. That is, A, say what the classic consensus is in a scientific area. Then if you don't agree with the consensus, say you don't agree and here's why we don't agree with the consensus and here's the evidence for our lack of agreement. And then once you've done that, say, and what I think you ought to do about the situation, my recommendation is, as a scientist who studied this area for a long time, my political recommendation is, if necessary, that you do X, Y, and Z. Uh-huh. You always make clear what the scientific consensus is. You always make clear if you differ scientifically. And then you always make clear that you have personal opinions that you've built from all your studies.
We have just a couple more minutes here.
Aren't you depressed enough now?
Yeah, no.
This
is what we
do. Fermented grape juice.
We do this every week.
I want to get back. You did talk about the imminent collapse a little bit earlier, and we've talked about that a lot on the program.
A lot.
Are we talking about? There are people who are talking about environmental collapse that may take place within 20 years. We've talked about people who say there will be economic, social, and cultural collapse that may beat us to the finish line. You published an article in Mob just a week ago that said, doesn't make any difference whether we have extinction or collapse. It's the end point is the same. Where do you see us going? We'll give you a chance.
I see us going in exactly the wrong direction. The problem is that it's very difficult to predict when and how. For example, with a lot of a fair group of colleagues have been interested in the issue of how you redesign a society to follow the collapse, the reset, the second round that doesn't have the huge problem, as you know, is growth mania. Mm-hmm. We need more people, more consumption, always to survive, and it can't work. So how do you design a reset where you don't have growth mania, where you have the kind of thing we had for a very long part of human history, sort of a stable population and not always trying to grow? And the problem is, if for example, both the Obama and the Trump administrations have worked very hard to make it more likely that we'll have a nuclear war with Russia. We've done things with our fusing and so on that scare the hell out of the Russians. And there's been a very close calls, as you know, with accidentally yes. starting a nuclear war. So if the collapse comes from a nuclear war, all the bets are off.
Right.
If the collapse comes from the debt pyramid collapsing, then maybe you'll have enough electricity, enough computers still around so that some of the knowledge we generate about what we might do can be preserved, although at the moment the best preservation is, as you may know, acid-free paper, because if you lose electricity, You're not going to have most of the knowledge of human beings left. So if the collapse comes from food rioting because global climate change is really screwing up the agricultural system, or if it comes from a global epidemic, the cause tells you what might be left over for a reset, and that's where I and most of my colleagues who are close colleagues are putting their thoughts and efforts. Mm-hmm. How do you get a reset? Nobody that I know thinks we're not going to have a collapse. Mm-hmm. There's been no sign at all that growth mania is going to end.
Right. So in the next minute that you have here.
Cheery, I know.
We're used to it. Do you have a project coming out of this reset idea, or what is your next project? Do you have something in the works that
you
want to...
Well, I've been a number of things. That has not formed into anything except some articles that I'm writing, but I'm working very hard with the colleague who introduced Sandra and me on a book on population extinction, which is a much bigger problem than species extinction at the moment, and I'm working with another colleague on a book that is going to look at could you put together with today's societies an ideal, anything like an ideal society? And I'm afraid to say that so far it doesn't look very cheering. But I'm habit formed. You know, I have great grandchildren. I'm actually sleeping with a great grandmother, if you want to know about perversions. and I feel a great obligation to try and make the world a better place, although I'm optimistic about what we might do, I'm very pessimistic about what we're doing.
We thank you, Paul Ehrlich. As always, you're an inspiration. We share your pessimism, we hear the gloom, but we also thank you for the amazing efforts you're making. Listeners, go to MAHB, M-A-H-B, Stanford Edu. Engage in the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere. Join Paul in this discussion of what he calls responding to the human predicament. Thank you, Paul Ehrlich, for being with us tonight on Ecotopia.
It's been my great pleasure again.
Ours too. Thanks.